on this week's program, a conversation with Philadelphia Orchestra President James Underkoffler. He's just completed his first year in charge of the group. WRTI critic at large Leslie Valdez has a review of the week she spent at the Marlborough Chamber Music Festival. In our continuing series about what it takes to bring theatre to life, Jason Pfeiffer explores the multifaceted and influential role of the artistic director. And Susan Lewis looks at public art and the Fairmount Park Art Association, a non-profit group that has been promoting public art in the park and in the city as a whole for over a century. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
James Underkoffler's first year as president of the Philadelphia Orchestra has been an eventful one. Much controversy surrounded the announcement last October of music director Christoph Eschenbach's decision to not renew his contract beyond the end of next season. This left the orchestra in the seemingly impossible position of having to find a replacement in under 2 years. The situation was remedied by the appointment of longtime orchestra collaborator Charles Dutoit as interim artistic director. When Underkoffler was appointed, he spoke of his desire to quickly implement many technological innovations to make the orchestra more accessible to current audiences and to potential new fans. To this end, in the past year, the orchestra has opened an online music store, has begun podcasting, and has broadcast a live concert in high-definition video over Internet 2, a high-speed fiber-optic network. When I spoke with James Underkoffler earlier this week, I first asked him if his first year in charge of the orchestra had been as he had expected.
I don't believe that there were any surprises beyond those that I imagined, and it's certainly been an eventful year.
It has been that, because certainly Christoph making the decision to move on wasn't something you would have foreseen, I guess, August of last year.
No, not necessarily, although, you know, there had been talk, but it certainly wasn't something that I thought would play out the way it did, but it did. And, of course, he'll be returning on a regular basis, which is terrific news. So I believe that we've worked through our issues and our future with Christoph, and I'm very pleased about that.
And in the process, you've got yourself or bought yourself some time. You're not now in a situation where you're being rushed into finding a replacement because you have Charles Dutoit. That seems to be working out rather well as well. Was there a secret plan for all of this?
No, there was no secret plan whatsoever. But clearly the Dutoit decision is playing out as a good one. And he's a wonderful collaborator. And the audiences seem to be responding very positively to him.
And the musicians.
And the musicians as well. It's a very interesting dynamic.
Speaking of dynamics, how difficult is it going to be to get 100 talented, sometimes temperamental musicians to agree on who the next music director, for instance, will be of the Philadelphia Orchestra?
I do believe that they will be in agreement on a music director candidate because the design that the musicians have agreed to is a very, very inclusive one that will ensure input from everyone, maybe even insist on input from everyone. And in that regard, the leadership of the orchestra is particularly strong right now and impressive. You know, Eric Carlson, who's head of the members committee, is a very strong leader, as is Hal Robinson, who heads the artistic committee. So I'm really encouraged by that.
When you were appointed in March of last year, we had a conversation about what your immediate aims were. And among them, you cited the use of new technology to bring classical music to perhaps a younger audience or to an audience that wasn't being tapped as well. You've now got your online store. You're in the process of setting up video concert broadcasts. What's left to be done in that department? It seems to have happened all rather quickly.
Well, I won't take full credit for that because we've had wonderful participation from all sectors in putting this together. My experience in technology before here and here as well just tells me that we need to be involved in all aspects of it at all times and that it will evolve as we become more, well, maybe in two ways. One, as we become more conversant with the possibilities and how they change, but as we develop a production team, which is in process right now. So where it's going beyond this, it did come together very quickly. It will be different in 5 years. That's all I can say.
And ideally, where would you like that to be? Would it be a situation where, I don't know, every public school in Philadelphia can, during the week, watch a Philadelphia Orchestra concert?
Well, the goal is to be able to reach audiences of all ages in a significant and meaningful way. And clearly, in discussion is how we can reach the public schools. After we do this rollout in the coming year to colleges and universities is how we can reach public schools. That requires a collaborative relationship, of course. And so that's one that I will be working on this coming year.
What other ambitions are there on your list of your to-do list?
Well, in addition to the electronic media initiatives, we've been looking at our audience, and not just the audience who's there when you come, but the audience who may have come once or the audience who hasn't been coming. Doing extensive market research, finding out what motivations there are for attendance, for continued attendance, for non-attendance, and so on and so forth. I'm particularly interested in product segmentation. And sounds like I'm selling toothpaste, so I apologize. but how we can attract audiences based on what their expectations are for a musical event. And then after that musical event, having met their expectations, where do we go from there? And how do we see not only segment to attract audiences, but how do we sequence events to develop that audience?
Is that then about creating different concert formats?
The basic thing that the Philadelphia Orchestra does and almost every other American orchestra does is pretty much the same as it has done for decades, and that is present what we in the office call blend concerts, where you have an overture, a soloist, and a symphony, and generally of different time periods, and that the adventuresome piece, maybe the 20th century or 21st century pieces, is positioned in such a way that the audience won't leave, right? We're interested in changing that format to some degree. We understand that maybe as many as 50% of our audience like that format, and so we will stay with that. And the other half varies from wanting music more adventuresome, which is a surprise, I think, to many. Some want it more traditional, some want it in different formats. And so we're really looking at, are we addressing audience interests and wants? And we're looking at it as soon as the 2008-09 season.
James Underkoffler. He's just completed his first year as president and CEO of the Philadelphia Orchestra.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
WRTI critic-at-large Leslie Valdez was sad to see the summer close on music at the Marlborough Chamber Music Festival this past weekend. She cheered up, knowing the best of these summer ensembles will have winter tours in several cities, including Philadelphia.
Rudolf Serkin wanted to get away from everything in the summer and just play sonatas with his father-in-law, the violinist Adolf Busch. They chose rural Vermont, a low-key campus called Marlborough, and the rest is history for chamber music. 57 years later, Marlborough is still unpretentious, still miles from everything, still the place to hear the most inspiring string quartets, piano, and woodwinds. The grounds are unmanicured, the apple trees neglected, but for 6 weeks, some of the world's most passionate and disciplined performers dive into music intended for intimate quarters. The first 3 weeks, there are no concerts, while ensembles are divvied up among 80 equal partners of all ages, ready to rehearse. Concerts are the last 3 weekends. If a work isn't ready, it isn't performed. Chamber music invades the spirit, and the soul of Mr. Serkin lives on. Things are not all high tone. My father was human, Serkin's oldest daughter Ursula says one morning in the dining hall, where her father used to throw napkin spitballs after all. A tradition that remains. At Persons Auditorium, Serkin's other daughter Judith, a cellist, sits knitting during a rehearsal of Beethoven's Choral Fantasy, the festival's perennial finale. I was sorry I had to miss the Serkin favorite that leaves many misty-eyed. Ignaz Solzhenitsyn conducted the Beethoven this summer. At a public rehearsal, I heard the 19-year-old Russian Ignat Levitt serving as rehearsal pianist for artistic director Richard Good, who would perform it later that day. Levitt did a splendid job. I also heard Levitt perform in the Mendelssohn Piano Trio with violinist Lucy Chapman and a remarkable young violist, Rebecca Albers. Every note this young man Levitt touches gleams. The final weekend began with Schoenberg's first string quartet, Transfigured Night. It was played without excess, each movement building and sustaining tension, a transformation built on restraint. The first violinist was Yona Zur, the second violin Hiroka Yajima, chair of Manas's string department and a protege of the late Felix Gallimere. The violist was Jonathan Vinicor, new principal of St. Louis Symphony. Michal Korman, a cellist from Israel, studies at Juilliard. The woman who performed Beethoven's Opus 59 No. 2, the Razumovsky, the other night, deserve a rave. Leading from the cello was Marcy Rosen of the Mendelssohn Quartet. Miho Sagusa, a young Japanese girl, was on first violin. Albers again on viola. Celeste Golden on second violin. Music making like this is very hard to describe, as hard as Vermont's shimmering night sky. Fortunately, Marlborough Ensemble's tour, giving three concert series in the winter in New York, Boston, Washington, Greenwich, Connecticut, and of course here.
WRTI critic-at-large Leslie Valdez. A touring ensemble from the Marlborough Chamber Music Festival will perform a Philadelphia Chamber Music Society concert at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia on November 4th. In non-profit theatre, the most prominent figures, aside from actors, are artistic directors, the artistic representative of the institution to the public. And playbills, websites, and theatre brochures commonly include welcome messages from artistic directors. Being a spokesperson, however, is only one aspect of this job. As part of our continuing series about what it takes to bring theatre to life, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer now explores the multifaceted and influential role of the artistic director.
As a rule of thumb, there are two people at the helm of a theatre company. There's the managing director, who oversees the business and administrative side of things, and there's the artistic director, who oversees all things creative.
I always knew I wanted to be an artistic director. I knew it in high school.
Terry Nolan is the co-founder and artistic director of the Arden Theater in Philadelphia. When Nolan, Amy Murphy, and Aaron Posner started the company in 1988, they established a mission, to tell great stories by great storytellers. Nolan says his company's mission defines the core essence of his work.
My primary job is to make sure that we are fulfilling our mission, that we are bringing to our stage plays that are indeed great stories.
Different companies have different mission statements, but the artistic director's charge is the same across the board. See that the company is fulfilling its mission. Robin Marcotte, co-artistic director of the Hotel Obligado Theater Company, calls this being a vision keeper.
That's like the top hat that we wear, but there's so many caps underneath that we're constantly wearing. It's kind of wearing dual hats a lot, but I think a lot of artistic directors fall into those roles.
Especially for a company like Hotel Obligado, which is on the smaller side, artistic directors can be involved in just about any aspect of a theater, from performing to writing to stuffing envelopes. But fundraising, programming a season, hiring directors, helping to cast the actors, selecting designers, and crafting the artistic vision and style of a company are all commonly part of an artistic director's job description. Sarah Goranczyk has been the artistic director for the Philadelphia Theater Company since 1982. She says this sort of influence over a company makes it a coveted position in the theater industry.
Certainly not every especially successful director really wants the administrative shackles of being an artistic director, but by and large, it's a wonderful position to have. And I don't think that there is any shortage of artistic leadership in the ranks.
Because there isn't an abundance of artistic director positions out there, many who aspire to do this sort of work often start their own companies. This is the case with many theaters in the Philadelphia region, home to well over 100 producing groups. Relative to other major theater hubs across the country, like Chicago, Seattle, Minneapolis, D.C., and of course New York, Philadelphia is a seasoned but young theater town. Jamie Haskins, managing director of the Wilma Theater and former executive director of the Theater Alliance of Greater Philadelphia, says this makes the local artistic directors a unique bunch.
So many of our theaters are led by artistic directors who have been with those organizations for a long period of time. And really, people identify with the artistic leadership of an organization. So I think having been around the country and seen a lot of different places and looked at what's happened when there's been transition in the artistic leadership, it becomes more about the building or it becomes more about the reputation of the organization. But I think here in Philadelphia, we still have a lot of companies that are identified by those who are leading those companies.
As company leaders, artistic directors essentially have the final say in all matters artistic. The Arden's Terry Nolan notes this isn't to suggest an artistic director should always exert his or her power, for instance, when dealing with a director.
I try to give them the room they need to make the decisions that they want, to hire the people they want, to approach the show the way that they want to do it. Because I do think that though collaboration is essential to the success a director and an artistic director have, that ultimately work isn't made by committee. It's made by passion and by a strong point of view. And so try to hire directors and then, you know, turn the resources of the theater over to them.
Allowing a strong point of view to come through is also a priority to Philadelphia Theater Company's Sarah Goronczyk. She sees herself as a director's ally.
I'm there to support them and to give them ideas if they want them. They're here because we've asked them to be here and because we like their work and we give them a fair amount of freedom.
Empowering directors is close to the heart of many artistic directors because most have extensive experience directing. Indeed, turning the theater's resources over to someone else for a show isn't always necessary. A lot of artistic directors will direct a couple shows each season, but some don't. Sarah Goronczyk hasn't been at the helm of a production since 1989, when she decided to stop directing.
I did not feel I personally could continue to stage direct and really lead the company where it needed to go. I could not do those two things simultaneously.
Not all companies work with the model of a central point of view, however, be that a director or an artistic director. Hotel Obligado, for instance, strongly believes in creating their work as an ensemble. Reflective of that ethos, they have two artistic directors. Robin Marcotte says that he and his co-artistic director, Don Filato, tried to steer the group through consensus.
I guess Don and I have the final say as to, like, when, if we can't reach a consensus of something, what happens. But we actually have never reached that point, which is really great because it's just, it shows we have the right people in the right roles. Something we always reiterate to each other. We can never really be married to an idea. We have to just make sure we're flexible enough to keep the company's growth in mind, not our personal idea in mind.
After all, supporting the growth and overall mission of a company is really what an artistic director's job boils down to. As Philadelphia theaters grow older, the time will eventually come when many companies will need to appoint new people to take over this work of being a vision keeper. When that happens, it will be an opportunity for the region to see in a fresh way just how much sway an artistic director truly has over the artistic direction of a company.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Fine art may sometimes seem like a luxury for the wealthy, but in Philadelphia, people of all means can enjoy art on street corners, plazas, and parklands, and not just any old art. Work by great artists like William Rush, Jack Lipschitz, Klaus Oldenburg, and the Calder family, just to name a few. This bounty is no accident, but the result of an early and continuing effort to keep art in the public sphere. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at the Fairmount Park Art Association and the tradition of public art it continues to protect and preserve.
It's 40 feet high and over 17 tons of bright red beams of steel. When Mark DeSouvereau's work titled Iroquois was installed on the grassy space across the street from the Philadelphia Museum of Art, it didn't look much like any of its neighbors. Not like the statues of statesmen, figures in the Rodin Museum, even contemporary representational works like the clothespin down the parkway opposite City Hall. The installation of Iroquois prompted praise and raised eyebrows, which is what Penny Bach, executive director of the Fairmount Park Art Association, expected.
It's noticeable if it's doing its job. And so in a way, it kind of becomes a lightning rod for people to comment on, to discuss, and that's all good. And I don't think there's any work of art anywhere in the world that everybody agrees on. So public art would be no different in that regard. It just happens to be out there for everybody. So therefore, everybody does have an opinion, and they're entitled to it. It's the great thing about public art.
Philadelphia has been home to outdoor art from its earliest days. Although the term public art was not yet in vogue, Bach says the first example of what we today think of as public art was created in 1809 by William Rush in his Fountain for Center Square.
In the sense that we think of it as a work that was specially commissioned, that was the work of a well-known artist, that had a meaning within the community. We're very sure it was the first public fountain commissioned with public funding. And so Rush himself really was the father of public art, in my view, certainly in Philadelphia.
Rush's sculptures also enhanced the Greek Revival structure of the Fairmount Waterworks, built to replace the city's water facility at Center Square. In the mid-1800s, sculptors like Alexander Calder were among those creating monuments for Philadelphia's first garden cemetery at Laurel Hill. The Fairmount Park Art Association was founded in 1872 as the city prepared to step into the international spotlight cast by America's centennial celebration. The association began with a mission to combat encroaching industrialization of the landscape and beautify the newly developing Fairmount Park. By the turn of the century, although its name didn't change, the association expanded its purview to include the city as a whole. Bach likens its mission to that of a museum.
To commission and acquire new work, to create a collection, to take care of that work, so we're involved with preservation and conservation. And thirdly, to interpret the work, so we're always interested in helping people understand more about the city's collection, and we try to promote it in every way we can. And also cooperating with other organizations that have since been established.
Today, the association works alongside these other public art initiatives. The Mural Arts Program, which has produced over 2,700 murals throughout the city since 1984, is directed by Jane Golden.
It's still about making sure that every citizen has access to art and that we use art as a catalyst for social change, whether it's within the individual person or child or within a community.
The Redevelopment Authority requires that private developers working on redevelopment land commit 1% of their construction costs to art. The city's public art program maintains city-owned art, manages the collection, and commissions work for new city construction through its Percent for Art program. City Public Art Director Margot Berg says sometimes the groups work together, as when the Art Association stepped in to save a city project.
When the Municipal Services Building was built, there was a Percent for Art requirement, and the artist selected was Jacques Lipschitz, and his proposal was for this Government of the People. The mayor at the time was Frank Rizzo. He saw the clay model or the plaster cast and despised it and berated it and basically cut off funding for it at that point. So it sort of languished, and then soon after the artist died, the Art Association came forward and had it cast and sort of finished the funding for it and had it installed so that the project was finished.
Some of the best-known work in Philadelphia is here by sheer force of public will, like the statue of President William McKinley outside City Hall. McKinley reportedly loved Philadelphia and had visited the city in 1898. After his assassination in 1901, the Philadelphia Inquirer began the public fundraising campaign, which collected $1 contributions from citizens and raised $50,000 for the sculpture. Penny Balkenbach says there's also the story of the nearby Love sculpture.
It was created by Robert Indiana. It was shown in Philadelphia. It then went back to the gallery, and people said, well, wait, you know, we're the city of brotherly love. Well, you know, this is for us. We need this.
In the end, civic leader Fitz Dixon purchased the sculpture and donated it to the city. Although the Love sculpture was not intended for its current home, many works are site-specific, such as the Remington Cowboy perched on a horse on a rock over Kelly Drive, or Rhine's Indian statue overlooking the Wissahickon Gorge, kneeling on Council Rock, where the Lenape Indians were said to have gathered. But every piece of public art changes its surroundings, bringing its own story and becoming part of a continuing saga.
You can, in many ways, trace the history of Philadelphia's social and cultural evolution by the public art in the city, if you understand the story behind each piece. One of the great public art stories is the story surrounding the All Wars Memorial to Colored Soldiers and Sailors.
The All Wars Memorial to Colored Soldiers and Sailors was commissioned by Hart, who's the first black state representative in Pennsylvania.
City planner Michael Ropel is the president of the All Wars Memorial to Colored Soldiers and Sailors Committee. The memorial was commissioned in 1927 and created by African-American artist Otto Schweitzer. 21 feet high in bronze and granite, it portrays six African-American military men. In 1934, the monument was supposed to be placed along the Benjamin Franklin Parkway at 21st and Vine. But civic forces blocked that placement, and the sculpture was instead installed behind Memorial Hall.
And then when they closed down Lansdowne Drive, because of the Horticulture Center, it became a dead-end road. So the only way you knew that that monument was back there was that you were lost.
In the course of researching a book about public art, Penny Bach of the Fairmount Park Art Association discovered the story of the monument and wrote an article about it.
And a group of African-American leaders said, well, can we move it? And they did.
Not only did they move it, they adopted it, setting up a trust fund to ensure its future yearly maintenance.
Well, it means a lot to the black community because in Philadelphia there's over 1,000 pieces of public art and only 3 that we know of are even dedicated to black. And this is the only one we know of that actually depicts black, has black figures. And you would think in a city like this that you'd see more black art.
The story of the war memorial, now in its proper place on the parkway, illustrates that controversy can cause mistakes, but it can also correct them. Controversy may be a constant companion to art, especially where compromise is required among multiple parties. But prompting praise and raising eyebrows, starting discussions and engaging people with their surroundings, telling the story of who we are, is perhaps what art, especially public art, is all about.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Catherine Blodgett, Debbie Fleischman, and Beth Yeagle. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.